You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome back to the 602 Club, TFM's local watering hole for everything outside of Star Trek. And I'm so excited to be here this week as we are going to be diving back in to the world of John Wick. And I have got one of my best assassin friends. I mean, if you can have friends in this business, none other than Scott McClellan. Scott, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
It's going well. You know, the best thing about best friends in the assassin business is that if you guys get killed, you know it's not going to be personal. So you know what? You know, it's...
Yeah. It's just business.
It's just business.
It's just business. Yeah, exactly. Well, very excited to be back here in the 602
Club. Well, I'm thinking
Club.
I'm back.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a terrible... terrible Keanu.
I was just going to let it go, but you had
yeah,
to.
Thank you.
You had to hang a lantern on it, so it's there.
Okay. Anyway, before we dive in, of course, give us a star rating review on Apple Podcasts. Help people find the show. Of course, you can also review us or rate us over on Spotify as well. Make sure you're following us on social media. You can find us all over the place. We're on X, Twitter, at The 602 Club. We're on Instagram at The 602 Club TFM. You can also find us on Letterboxd at The 602 Club. We're online on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM with the entire network. We're online at Trek.FM. And of course, there's a listeners only discussion group you can join. Talk to listeners from all over the world called the Babel Conference on Facebook, as well as joining us over at Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM. And making sure all of this content keeps coming to you each and every week. And so I wanted to ask you about this because actually you know, we talked about the Continental series together.
Yes, we did.
And I wanted to ask you about the idea of continuing this universe, the John Wick universe, because you know we're all well aware of the fact that John Wick seemingly dies at the end of 4. Even though there has been talk about there being a fifth film. And we both enjoyed the Continental series, but I don't think either of
I think you're misremembering. I did not enjoy that whatsoever.
Oh, you're right. No.
That was not a good review.
We thought that there were some interesting aspects to it, but it was not great as a show.
No, I was like, dude, what? You are misremembering this terribly. I was like, no, I did not enjoy the Continental whatsoever. So when you gave me the opportunity to come back for this one, I was like, oh, please, please, let's redeem having a really good John Wick discussion.
This is true. You know, I was trying to be fair and nice, but I guess, you know what? No, it really, yeah. Anyway, we could talk about it. And we did talk about it. So go find that episode there on the 602 Club feed where we're talking about the Continental series. Yeah, I guess that is a big question, though, is this idea. Okay, we're going to continue this universe, and the decision to try and continue that universe with the Continental series seemed to look like a good idea at the time, in the sense of, like, I can see how that would work, right? Like, that's an interesting story to tell us the backstory to Winston. How did he become the person that we know in the John Wick series, you know, how did Sharon get to where he is? All of those kind of things. That's a great idea. Execution has to be there. And
it wasn't.
It just wasn't. And so, which is unfortunate. So this idea of diving into the Kikamora and the Ruska Roma with a ballerina focused story, where were you kind of coming into this? What were you thinking about this? Were you actually excited about this idea, especially since, you know, their first foray without John Wick really as the main character didn't seem to go very well? And so how are you feeling coming into this one?
I will tell you, the first trailer sold me. That was the, I had been hearing, they've been talking about this ballerina movie for seemingly years. Like
it feels like years, right?
It feels like years. So, but I was down as long as it was going to be good. I will say that my negative reaction to the Continental miniseries did not factor into Ballerina. I had in my mind for some reason I thought movies, TV, the movie is going to be a whole different ball of wax. I did feel that. But then I remember being at work on my lunch break, or at least a break, when the first trailer for Ballerina dropped. And once I saw that trailer, I was like, oh, no, I'm in. No, we're good. Mm-hmm. Like that first trailer did an excellent job of making me go, I'm excited now.
You know, I think for me, the idea of doing this was interesting. You know, I think one of the beauties of the John Wick series is that it had created these interesting side groups that we got a chance to kind of see a little bit of, but we didn't really get to spend a ton of time with, especially the Rusca Roma and its connection with John Wick, and this idea that, you know, they train these different people, especially, you know, to be bodyguards for people. I mean, they're basically the anti-assassin assassins, you know, to keep people from getting assassinated.
They talk about wards instead of targets. Like you are a protector, not an assassin. But the cool thing was you didn't get any of that from the ballerina showing up in John Wick Chapter 3.
Right.
So what this film did, and I'm kind of already jumping into a bit of a review here, but it delivered, which was it took an element that was glimpsed at in the John Wick movies.
Yes.
And said, we have a story to tell.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, and I think the thing that kind of excited me about the idea of them doing this, and probably the biggest selling point for me, especially when the casting was announced and then the trailer came out, knowing that it was Ana de Armas and having seen her work, especially in this type of vein with what she did in No Time to Die, I thought, okay, I think she could be great in this role. And so therefore, continuing this universe with her as the role of the ballerina seems like the best possible choice you could make. Like, if we're going to do that, I have hope then this will actually be good as we dive into this. And so, and, you know, I think it does help that, you know, all the people involved with the John Wick series were involved heavily, you know, with this film and bringing it to life, much more so than, of course, were in the Continental series. You know, it's even come out that in that series, you know, they basically kind of disregarded a lot of the feedback, you know, that they got from somebody like Chad Stahelski, and of course, even John Wick himself, Keanu Reeves. And if you're doing that, you're probably not on the right wavelength to be involved in the John Wick series, because those two are the end all be all of this series.
They're mommy and daddy.
They're
mommy.
Yeah.
And no, if we don't listen to mommy and daddy,
yeah, you're probably wrong.
You're probably wrong. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, on top of continuing the universe, I think, you know, one of the interesting choices then that, you know, each of the John Wick movies, we watched them descend further and further kind of into this universe of assassins and give us new things they would add to the universe. It wasn't just about continuing in the sense of, oh, we're just going to basically give you more of the same thing. We're going to deepen the lore.
Well, and that was something that Stahelski, have you had an opportunity to watch the Wicca's Pain documentary?
I haven't.
Oh, dude. Okay, so this was released late May, digitally only right now.
Okay.
From Lionsgate. They've got actual home video behind the scenes from the production of the first John Wick movie.
Oh, interesting.
It's like $9.99. I paid my money. It's basically, remember those really awesome, almost feature-length making-of documentaries we used to get as special features on, like, DVD releases?
Yeah, like, you know, you think of the Lord of the Rings did it the best, right?
Yeah, Lord of the Rings did it the best, but then you also had, like, the Blade Runner documentary that came on the final cut.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I remember the first time they put the Bond movies on DVD, they all came with those dossier extras that was the making of the film, and they tended to be about a good 40 minutes on the making of each movie, which is amazing.
Empire of Dreams with the
oh my god,
the original Star Wars trilogy.
Yes.
So Wicca's Pain is in that vein. Like, if you love the John Wick movies, I mean, everybody that is a essential part of the creation of this franchise is a part of this documentary and interviewed directly.
Oh, wow. And, okay.
And
yeah,
so,
I'm going to have to get that.
Oh, no, no.
I'm buying it right now.
That's the correct answer. That's the correct answer. But Stahelski said every time there was the next one, it was the why. It was like, what do we have to do to justify another one? Like, that was the thing. And so the idea of deepening the lore was kind of his mission. Once Stahelski, because Stahelski and David Leitch co-directed the first one.
Right.
Stuff went down. The documentary details all of it. And Leitch kind of went off on his own thing. And Stahelski kind of devoted his foreseeable career to Wick. That's how committed he was to this universe. And his idea was, if we're going to do another one, what's next?
Yeah. Well, and in that vein, for this film, we absolutely add to the universe. We deepen the lore by creating this idea of a cult.
Yes.
The cult. I mean, that's all they basically refer to it as. And the cult is, in addition to all of these different assassin groups, you get the High Table, all that kind of stuff. I mean, seriously, the High Table is still something we haven't truly discussed or seen in a film played out. So they got to do that at some point. But this organization is one, according to the film, where in the world of assassins, they decide, well, Wouldn't it be nice if we were older and we wouldn't have to wait so long? That's for Brian Wilson, RIP, who just passed away today as we're recording. So thank you, Brian Wilson, for your genius and your music. You'll be missed. But this world of assassins decide, well, don't we want to have families? I mean, shouldn't we be able to have families? And of course, you know, while we're having those families, why don't we just have an entire basically town of assassins? And the kids know we're assassins. We're actually training them to be assassins from the basically the moment they're born.
It's a compound. Jonestown. Because you've got that charismatic, you know, I love how characters in this universe are like a title, the manager, the chancellor, the director, and like I just love the concierge. You know, they're always the inter job title, and so you get the chancellor, and he's the cult leader. He's the personality that everyone obeys without question, and his word is law, and it's. And they're all in this little tight-knit, secluded community so they can do their thing, you know, with no interference. And it's, but you're right. It wasn't just that this film introduced the cult. That was cool. But it was, okay, we showed you ballerinas in Chapter 3. We didn't explain the ballerinas in Chapter 3. We just showed you that they were there. Right. Well, this film, we're actually going to explain what the ballerinas are. And, oh, by the way, for extra credit, we're going to create a whole new group and add it to the universe. And that, and so for me, I wasn't even expecting that. I was just expecting the film to expand on the ballerinas. I didn't realize they were going to give me, you know, a side dish of something new. And I'm like, cool, you didn't just, you know, understand the assignment. Like I said, you went for bonus points.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that too, because with the addition of them in a, you know, as a different organization within this, one of the things that, you know, we learn, not only do they basically have this kind of Waco Jonestown society type of aspect to them, they're basically training assassins from birth, but they're also this group who plays by zero rules. So, you know, the world of assassins that we have seen in John Wick all have these kind of elaborate rules to set themselves apart from what they would say the animals. Right.
Winston even says that in chapter three when he's talking to the adjudicator.
Yes. And so I wanted to ask you about that part of this idea and how well you thought maybe that was set up. Because if there's one thing that I did think about the cult as I'm watching the film is that this whole idea that they don't follow the rules seem to be a little bit more nebulous than maybe I thought it could have been or should have been in the film, because they don't really necessarily show them disregarding all the rules in a way that's, I mean, other than, you know, I know that they go to the Continental and they've got these people and they're doing business on, you know, the Continental grounds and all that. But I don't know. It just seemed like it would have been nice just maybe one or two more times to really see them kind of breaking the rules of this universe in a way that might have helped in some ways, I think is really what I'm coming down to.
And that was not an aspect that I had personally pondered while watching the film, but I think it was also because the story of the film is rather generic if you really look at it. If I had a, you know, one of my critiques of the film is that other aspects of the film elevate it from a story that just, you know, on the page is, could be handled. Yeah, I'm not saying it was, but in lesser hands could have been handled as a generic revenge plot. I mean, because it's basically what it is. So the cult just comes across as, you know, it's a little bit more of they tell and don't show. They do, you know, they do have them doing business on Continental grounds. We know that's a big no-no. What I do love in the movie is that we actually like the theme of John Wick Chapter 3, which is rules and consequences. That's a mantra that repeats over and over again. And it plays in this film, since this film does take place during Chapter 3, which we'll discuss later. I liked having those consequences. I liked seeing consequences of rules being broken in a maybe a little bit more of a decisive manner than maybe we saw in the John Wick films. But I think that what you're saying is a fair critique. It just was not one that had occurred to me. They spend more time talking about the cult, like the Ruska Roma have basically like it's not really a truce. It's more of a, you don't mess with us, we don't mess with you. You know,
exactly.
We just agree to, we agree to disagree and leave each other alone. Winston has that whole conversation about better in the tent pissing out than outside pissing in.
Yes.
Which I think is probably the best.
Yes, I loved that.
That line is probably the number one characterization of the cult with regards to the greater world. We tolerate them so they don't screw with us. Because they're going to screw with other people.
You know, I mean, to put it in like geopolitical terms, it's slightly akin to the way in which most countries kind of feel about, you know, China these days, right? We tolerate them and we placate them in some ways so that we don't have to just necessarily actually deal with them, you know? And so, no, I think that's actually, a really well said and a great point for this whole thought process. And I think it's just one of the things, like you said, and another one of, I think, that the criticisms of the film is the sense that there is a little bit of, this sense that, that there is some generic nature to the movie. And yet I don't think it's necessarily really hurt terribly, because there's a lot of stuff that elevates that. And I think I wanted to ask you about this, because just that leads just the plot of the film itself, right? The idea of, you know, Eve, who, when we meet her in the movie, it's a flashback to seeing how she got to where she is, you know, sitting on this chair where Winston meets her, right, in this police office, in a police station. And, you know, her father being taken from her by these people who come to kill him and to kidnap her, and he dies saving her life. And then that spirals into her becoming a ballerina, finding out about the cults and going after them against orders of the director. And of course, that's where all the mayhem ensues from. And so, just plot in general, we've talked a little bit about that being
maybe
not the most ingenious plot we've ever seen. And so, how does all of that then kind of work for you? Did you feel like the movie engaged you and kept you interested and found ways to kind of overcome? And I don't want to say it derogatorily anyway, because I don't think this is like paint by numbers or anything like that. But it's rather, when it comes to revenge films, it's definitely on the basic side. And so what did you think about that, the way in which the plot then took all of this and moved the ball forward?
I'm going to be honest with you in that the plot is the one part of the movie that I feel like holds it back. There are, and it's kind of hard because I feel like I'm jumping into things that I know that we plan on discussing in more detail later in the podcast, but
sure.
What we just talked about, it's way of adding in a fruitful way to the mythology of the world of John Wick keeps me engaged. So while the plot is like yada, 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 the elements that they decorate the plot with that allow me to deepen my appreciation and understanding of the world of John Wick keeps me engaged. And then, because you got North 87 here doing, you know, what they do when it comes to action, I mean, the John Wick movies were good at telling engaging stories for the most part.
Yes. Yeah.
With amazing action. But this film benefits from a less engaging story, but done well, with enough new tidbits of the world to keep me going, and the action that I've come to expect from a John Wick related project, that really, you gave me what I came for. So if you gave me a, I'm not even going to say substandard plot, I'm just going to say a standard plot, but you put enough trimmings on it, you know, you hung enough ornaments on the tree to make it ooh nice and shiny, I got what I paid for. Like, I got what I came for, and I was good. Yeah. So I know that doesn't sound complimentary, but I think the point is that what the rest of the film does means that the plot just didn't bother me. I could acknowledge typical A to B plot, but I didn't care because everything else gave me what I was looking for.
I like the way that you put that a lot. You know, I think one of the most interesting things to be able to do in any movie is to be able to kind of rise above convention.
Mm-hmm.
And the plot here, of course, because it's in the John Wick franchise, right? There is a convention to which it has created in and of itself, right? Which is this idea of the revenge plot, which, you know, we've seen in cinema. We've got famous movies that are about this type of idea.
It's a genre. And it's a genre within itself.
Exactly. Exactly. And so the biggest part about this becomes, okay, how are you going to then make that your own and transcend that? You know, can you do it with the action that you give them? Can you do it with the characterization that you give them? Can you do it with those type of things so that I'm not sitting in the film trying to dissect, okay, how do you get from here to here and who's connected with what and all that stuff? It really, to me, I think, comes down to I need to be engaged with the main character of the film so that all of the other stuff kind of floats away, and my main focus and drive is, do I connect with the main character? So I'm on their journey, regardless of whether or not their journey mirrors any other journey that I might have seen in cinema. And I think that's the thing that, for me, when it comes to Eve's story, is the best part of the film. It's the thing that I, you know, coming into the movie, I was hoping would be the thing that would keep me engaged, and that was the ballerina herself. The fact that this tiny dancer is played by Ana de Armas, right? And this is her movie. She has to carry the movie. And I think, to me, the thing that makes this film work is that I'm fully engaged with her as a character and as the actress to bring me along on the road that she's on, and the choices that she's going to make and what that's going to mean for her as a character. And, you know, it wasn't like because of her performance, it wasn't till, you know, very about midway through the film where I kind of caught on, oh, she's related to the Chancellor some way, right? Like, those type of things began to come into my mind, but it was more because I was paying attention to dialogue and performance and that type of stuff and the other things that were going on in the movie, where the moment, you know, where the young little girl is taken, I was like, oh, that probably means Eve was actually related, you know? And yet I wasn't pulled out by being able to figure that out. I was then more invested to the story on how it was actually going to kind of trickle down to the rest of the plot, you know?
Well, that was interesting because so, I figured out from the first scene, because nice. The Chancellor talks about that her father married, like, I pretty much think he states, you married my daughter. Like, I thought that was pretty clear in that first scene. The one,
yes,
yeah. my moment of realization was I figured it out, you know, not as soon as she showed up, but when the female cultist showed up at the Prague, or was it the German continental? I think she was.
Yeah, she was in the Yeah, I believe you're right.
Right. I didn't figure it out right then, but she kept on hanging around long enough for me to go, oh, you're the quote-unquote dead sister. Okay.
Like, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That was the one that, that was the one for me where I was like, oh, yeah, this is the reveal. Okay. And luckily, the movie didn't make a big deal about the reveal. Like, it was like, no, we weren't really, like, we didn't expect you to be completely fooled. You know, there are some times where a movie lets you know, hey, did we get you? And you go, no, you really didn't.
Yeah.
I saw this coming like 10 minutes ago. I don't feel like the film treated it like that. It just was like, yeah, this is a thing, you know. And so that was the moment of that happened. I'd already figured it out. And it didn't bother me when I ended up being right, because usually I'm the kind of guy that's like, seriously, I knew that. Like, thanks. You didn't hide it that well. So, and I didn't have that reaction to this film because, like you said, I was engaged. I was going with it. As per Ana de Armas's performance as Eve, I liked her. There's something that we're going to talk about. Once again, I keep on wanting to talk about the action, and I'm sorry, but it's a John Wick movie.
No, we'll get there. Don't worry, people. We're going to talk about the action.
But I think the way Anna portrayed Eve in a vulnerable but also badass way, and I felt like this actually worked. And when we talk about the action, I'm going to in detail break down why this didn't bug the absolute snot out of me, but actually made me buy in more to this character when I talk about vulnerability while also badass. You know, there's she did it well, and I know she can do it. I haven't seen a lot of movies with Anna, but the ones that I have seen and enjoyed have been well. You know, Blade Runner 2049, she was excellent as the hologram in that movie. And then you mentioned Paloma from No Time to Die. You know, she's had some strong outings. And then there's a lot of other stuff that I just haven't, you know, checked out. So honestly, I was kind of like, this movie could be a coin flip for me. Like, she could just be a pretty face who's leading this movie, or she could actually, like, make it work. My biggest hope was, I mean, you get Les Wiseman directing the movie. I love the first Underworld film. And you've also got Stahelski there with North 87. And I know they make the actors, like, do the work. So I was not worried in that aspect. But Anna did pull me in. I enjoyed this film. She did not come across as stiff. You know, those are always my concerns when you have the hot, in this case, I mean hot as in popular. I don't mean hot as in
no,
hot.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, the hot actress or actor at the time, you know, that everybody's kind of like keen to get into something because they've got a name that's popping, you know, and exactly. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. And you know, again, to me, the two things that keyed me into what she was going to do, hopefully, in this film were seeing her in No Time to Die, where I thought she was great. She was one of the best parts of the film. She really landed that role in a way that she was so fun and vibrant, and just like her character just really pulled me in, which I loved. But then on the other side, right, I think the other film that I keyed in for her that I thought, okay, I think that she can really pull off drama is, you know, I saw her in Blonde.
And I still have not, like, that has been on my to-watch list forever. Yeah.
And you know, that's also a rough movie to watch anyway. And so, you know, but if you watch that, she's got the drama part down perfectly. She's excellent at it. She does a great job at it, you know. And so those two things is like, okay, so she can do everything that they're going to require her to do. And not only on top of that, but I mean, she also did the action so well in No Time to Die. And so... I mean, this is just, I think this is one of those things where, I thought that, again, she's the thing that pushes this kind of beyond convention and into making it something where, yes, I could maybe sit down and if I'm just really not drawn into the movie, I'm going to figure everything out and it's going to kind of be blasé. And yet she keeps it from being that. And so I really enjoyed her performance in the movie. And I loved, you know, the fact that, like you mentioned, and I think it's a perfect time to talk about this movie, we get somebody to basically mirror where John Wick is in the moment of the timeline, which we can talk about in a second, but that the choices that he's made in his life have led him down a certain path, right? And he can look at Eve where she is in her life and be able to speak into that and say, this is about choices and consequences. And the choices you are going to make right now are going to lead you to certain consequences. And you may or may not like that idea. And of course, you know, she's even called out in the film. She's Eve, right? She has the ability. Does she take the forbidden fruit of revenge, or does she let that go and find a way to live a life beyond that? And is she ready to face the consequences then of her choices? And that's what the whole movie is about. And what I love about that is that as ridiculous and silly as all this is, it truly is a movie that speaks to our world and saying, no, you are responsible for your choices. You are responsible for the consequences that come because of that. And you need to be able to take responsibility for that. And she chooses, knowing that there are going to be consequences for those actions, and she's willing to live up to those consequences as well and not just blame other people for what happens to her. And I absolutely love that about this film.
Well, and also, even as an audience member, you're watching the movie the whole time going, don't do it. It's like, don't do it, do it.
Because, yes,
like,
yes.
It's like, don't do it because your life would be better, but please do it because this is going to make a really entertaining movie when you do
exactly.
When you do it. It's like, please don't do that.
Yes, do it.
And, you know, but I also like how she makes those... She makes those stupid decisions the characters make in movies that, you know, get themselves into massive trouble. But I never felt frustrated with her making, like, they didn't come across as dumb. They just came across as, yeah, I get it. You know, it's,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's, you're like John Wick going, I understand. You know, it always goes back to the, let's remember this entire series of films is him going on a killing spree because they stole his car and killed his dog. You know, it's
yeah, yeah.
You know, John Wick really has no ground to stand on when it talks about the choices that you make in your life. But he's also the guy who's near the end of his, if you look at the scope of his films, and when we talk about the timeline. And he can look back now and go, could have done things differently.
Yeah, it's a great point.
But that's also a great intersection of this film, because John Wick is the super slick pro, been at this for 10 plus years. I mean, he is the Baba Yaga for a reason. You know, he has done the things many times over. Eve is literally 2 months in. Yes. And it shows.
Yeah.
And that's what's beautiful about the movie is the movie does not shy away from going, yeah, you've been doing this for 2 months. And so she's young and impetuous, not making the best choices in a lot of different things, in the way she fights, in the way, the way she handles people and situations. And I love it how John Wick in the film kind of functions as the, I'm the example of what happens if you continue down this path for the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
If you survive that long.
Yes.
And I'm telling you, look at me. Is this worth it?
Yes. I think that is so well said. And again, you know, that's the interesting thing about the place in the timeline then that we put this film, in the sense that this happens, the main action of the movie takes place during Chapter 3 of John Wick, Parabellum. And of course, you know, we have the flashback that was happening way before that, like 12 years before the events of John Wick 3. And so, you know, obviously they have to work in the time frame that they've created for the John Wick films. The fact that, I mean, he's dead for all that we know in after 4. And so how did you feel like then that their placement of this movie in the timeline worked?
I think what happens is that the first time that you really get it like spelled out for you is, of course, the fact that you're getting Eve's perspective of the tear my ticket scene from Chapter 3. Like, that's the scene that establishes we are now at this point in the John Wick timeline, because we even get clips from Chapter 3.
Yes.
And we see scenes from Chapter 3 from a different perspective. Because it's really fun, if you watch Chapter 3 before you watch Ballerina, you see a scene, you kind of see him look around, and then you, and I love how they go back and retcon what he's looking at. You know, it's a fun thing that you can do when you have a scene with limited context, and then you can invent context, you know, around the scene that you've already created.
Yes.
The question that a lot of people have had, and I have headcanon, it's not perfect because I can point out some, I'm not going to say inconsistencies, but I'm going to say some challenges they've given themselves for the timeline of the rest of the movie. Because you've got the tear your ticket scene, and then the rest of the film jumps 2 months later. And then it plays out from that point on. The biggest question people have had is when John Wick shows up in the third act of the film, which I will go ahead and say, from all the word that I heard about the extensive reshoots that were done to this film, it's speculation on my part, but I'm going to say that it's very clear to me that most of that third act, final scene, a final action sequence at the end with John Wick was added in the reshoots. I get the sense that that was not the original version of Ballerina. So the question becomes, when you add John Wick into the third act of the movie, which is not a spoiler because it's in the trailer. I actually wish that wasn't in the trailer. That would have been really cool for that to have happened and me not to know it was going to happen. I started looking at, okay, based on how Chapter 3 ended, because I did watch Chapter 3 before, like the night before I saw Ballerina, because I wanted to play this game. If you look at him when he gets off the train in the village, he's in the black suit, the black shirt, the black tie, which is the outfit that the elder gives him in the desert after he finds him. And, you know, he has to chop off his ring finger. And then he gets the mission to go back to New York and kill Winston. So based on how the rest of chapter three happens, because once he gets back to New York, we've got everything that happens with the Winston and the attack on the Continental and all of that. And then that leads right into chapter four. So in my mind, because he's in that particular suit, and if you watch carefully on his left hand, he's missing the ring finger. Like, they digitally removed his finger to fit within the continuity of the films. So my belief is that when John Wick shows up for the third act, he's left the Elder in the desert, and he's on his way back to New York. So this happens before he gets back to New York for the final act of Chapter 3. That's my headcanon. Now, is it perfect? No, because the director doesn't have the holes in her hands from when the adjudicator pronounced a judgment on her and they, like, slash the sword blade through her hands.
Right.
So it gets a little murky. It gets a little murky there. But Chapter 3 also doesn't specifically tell you how long. I mean, you got to think, after he tears his ticket, he's got to get all the way to Casablanca. Then from Casablanca, he has to go to some unspecified desert. He has to wander for an unspecified time in the desert. Then he has to get himself out of the desert and get back to New York. And the film never bothers to tell us how long that all took. So I think it's elastic enough in its timeline to say, yeah, this could be happening before he gets back to New York at the end of Chapter 3. So that's how I think it fits in. Now, the movie doesn't spell any of this out, but I'm glad it doesn't, because I think if it tries to spell it out, I think people can poke more holes in it if you try to be specific instead of being vague and letting fans just kind of make up whichever version they want it to be.
Yeah, see, I what you just laid out is exactly kind of what I thought about it. I mean, it's like, no, I mean, it fits, right? And this is a... The thing about this film is that in this whole universe, right? It's make-believe, guys.
Fictional characters!
You know, I don't need everything, you know, perfect. I mean, even Star Wars, right? It's like, we didn't know that Luke was going to be Leia's sister and twin sister until the third film, right? And so, and neither did Lucas. Okay.
He was making that up as he went along.
Right. At that point, he was, you know? So it's, again, like, and I think the thing that this actually does best, and what I actually love about having John Wick in the film is, and this was something I couldn't believe happened, they don't try to pretend that Eve is in the same league as John Wick.
Oh, no, he gives her a spanking. Like, he toys with her.
Yes, she just gets cooked. I mean... It's fantastic. And so in that, because so many times, right, when you have a male and a female character going against one another in a film, the way in which we try to make the female character better than the male character is by having her kick his butt, even though there's no way in God's green earth that was going to happen, especially with the ramifications of, like, how, you know, where the character is in their timeline and their own story and everything. And no, we take all of that into account here, and we put her in her place, but in a way that helps us understand, okay, we've seen her do some pretty amazing stuff, but when she comes up against the best there is, she still's got a lot to learn. And but that is actually great for the character. It doesn't take anything away from her. It actually helps ground the character and make her actually feel more real.
Well, and even if you're not up against the freaking Baba Yaga, even the characters that she did fight, to your point, I was very concerned there was going to be this very cringe fight like a girl aspect to the movie. I mean, there's even that song, the Evanescence Rice, that plays during the credits.
Well, but, and they talk about it earlier.
And they talk like about it earlier with Kikimora.
Unfair, right?
Right. Yeah. But the point is that you've got to fight like a girl. You've got to cheat. Because you're not
right.
going to
exactly.
win if you let them, and in that case, they're referring to, you know, a male who is going to be bigger, stronger, maybe faster, but you can be faster. Yeah. You know, the point is, if you fight like they do, they're going to win. You've got to fight like you can win, which means using your advantages. And I loved that because
yes, exactly
it, what
exactly
I even wrote this in my Letterboxd review, which I will plug at the end of the podcast. Shameless plug.
No, go for it.
You're the one thing that always got me when. And I'm not saying that women can't beat men. Absolutely. But there's a certain situation where if you've got a 300-pound guy the size of Mount Rushmore and you're on a day or Moz, who you can have nice, lean, cut muscle, but you're still not going to cold cock a 300-pound dude and knock him out.
Yeah, you're not – like you just said, you're not going to be able to sucker punch and knock out The Rock. It's just not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But you can still win if you are creative and you – and as I say, she didn't – in all the fights leading up to that point and even after, they didn't just let her win. She perseveres.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. That is a great way to put it.
She finds a way to beat them and she takes her licks. And
well, it's because she's creative.
It's because she's creative. Because it's not pretty. It's not slick.
No.
But
yeah.
She gets the job done. But they didn't make it easy for her, which for me
exactly.
means you respect the character enough to realize she's going to have some challenges. You can't just wave your magical fictional wand and say that the 120-pound girl is going to knock out the 300-pound guy.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
you can shoot the dude in the head. Like, that's, like, yeah. you can still do that.
Yeah. Well, and again, that is the beauty of the way in which, you know, having John Wick in the film, I think, absolutely helps the story instead of taking away from it. And so that's the place that I was really thankful that they just played this perfectly. And, you know, so I didn't feel like John Wick coming into the movie, you know, took anything away from it. I felt like it actually enhanced the film because it allowed us to because we know the level that John Wick is at, right?
He killed three guys with a pencil.
Exactly. So it allows us to then be able to measure her against the best there is and be able to see the growth that needs to happen for her to be at a level maybe comparable at some point, but to know that she's not there yet. And that actually helps us then in that sense of like – sequel opportunities,
yes.
all of those kind of things.
Because it gives her growth opportunities
right.
for – it gives her an arc for sequels.
Right. Because and if there's any kind of maybe detriment to the John Wick films, right, is that we already knew that John Wick was the best. And he's always the best. And you never really kind of worried for his life at all throughout the movies because he's the best. Who's going to kill John Wick? Everybody knows he's the best. They talk about the fact that he's the best all the time. And so allowing Eve to be a different type of character then, who's going to then grow into possibly being the best, I think it really makes for it's a very smart move because you don't want to just clone John Wick and put a female body on that. You really want to create a character that has their own sense of being in this universe and gives you a reason for then wanting to watch them be their own person in this universe because they have a story that I don't know just what's going to happen. You know, when she goes into a fight, I'm thinking to myself, okay, how does she get out of this one? Because it's not going to be easy for her because she's still got room to grow. So all of that, I think, is just really well done in their part.
Well, they also understood the assignment in that even when we meet John Wick in the first movie, he was an assassin for an undetermined amount of time. He was already a legend and then retired 5 years and then comes back and starts killing people like there's no tomorrow. I mean, the scene I always love in the first movie is the one where, you know, the bad guy is talking to John Leguizamo and he's like, "I understand that you struck my son." "Yes, sir, I did." "Mm-hmm. Why did you do that?" "Because you stole John Wick's car and killed his dog."
Oh. Right.
You know, it's like that was the scene to let you know, oh, it's about to go down. You know, but Eve, this is an origin story. We're not talking about the retired veteran who comes out of retirement. We're literally watching her start. That's the point of the movie. And so I'm just so glad that they understood that in the story. They let her make mistakes. They let her fights and kills be messy.
Yes.
Which, in a way, the action endears the character to you because it really shows you how, in an action movie, stunt choreography tells a story. Stunt choreography can, when done expertly, like North 87 does, is character development.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. And you talking about that, you know, is the perfect time to kind of dive into the action. And that's one of the things, you know, it's fascinating that this film, they allowed them to be able to come back and film more action sequences because they're like, yeah, we like this. We think it should have more action in it, not less. And I loved that a lot of the action felt different from a lot of the John Wick films with John Wick as doing the action because he's so polished. And I liked that many of these fights were kind of a much more visceral. I mean,
chaotic.
Having the, yes, let's use grenades, you know? So
I have no guns. Which is funny because I have got grenades. The plates.
I just saw the Phoenician scheme where he keeps giving grenades to people. And I kept thinking, I want to see somebody use a grenade. And she finally used a bunch of grenades. It was great.
Well, and then I love like the plates, like her and the rest and the like the bartender and like, bow, you know, the fact that they're trying. But I love the point is the guns underneath the plates. So it's like they're trying to get to the gun. But why not use the plates you're picking up while you're at it trying to get to the gun? You know, I love I love the use of metal doors and tables and things that, you know, if she's going to use explosives and bullets, she's using her environment to go, this is the only way I'm going to protect. Because she's also not wearing
the ice skates.
That was, once again, creative. You just want to go, what kind of sick mother thinks this stuff up?
I mean, the action was great in this movie, and one of the things that I think
flamethrowers,
the beauty of the action, and flamethrowers and you know, water hoses. It differentiated itself enough from the action that we had seen in the John Wick films with him as the main character, and yet it felt like it's like, yeah, this is the cousin of, right? We are related, but we want to make this series have its own sense of style and its own feeling. We don't want just a John Wick clone. We want this movie to kind of feel like it's its own thing. And that, I think, is just a really, really great idea.
When they do use John Wick in the movie, then not only do you have the scene where he Spanks, you know, he's like Papa Spank when it comes to Eve. But there's also the scene where we've seen her go through all the cult members in the village and what her kills are like. And then you see John Wick go pop, 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 pop. You know, he's gung-fuing all over the place. And so, once again, even the action, when I talked about character development, you even understand, you see her struggles with these characters. And then you see John Wick just cut through them like a hot knife through butter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, once again, the choreography fit the characters so that you got to see something new and different and a little bit more chaotic and a little bit more entropy. And then it's like a comfort food. Here's John Wick, and we're going to give you a taste of, you know, the John Wick style as he just, like, blows through them like a lawnmower through grass.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we got to talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, this is the last thing that Lance Reddick films, the fact that he's in the movie. You know, I think that is possibly one of the difficult things to know of if they continue this series. And, you know, he won't get a chance to be a part of it. And it was just, it was so great to have him be in this movie because he's such an integral part to the series. And it was so great. Seriously, it's just wonderful to see him on screen this last time. And I'm very thankful, you know, that they were able to have these scenes filmed, you know, before he passed away, because, you know, obviously you couldn't have really done this movie in the time period that they set it in kind of without him. And yeah, I mean, it was just kind of awesome to have him back.
It was really weird to see him in the marketing because, you know, it was already weird walking into Chapter 4 and he had already died like... I don't remember exactly how close to the release of Chapter 4, but it felt uncomfortably close. Like, we hear Lance Reddick dies, and then we're watching Chapter 4. And then, of course, the uncomfortable irony that Sharon dies in Chapter 4. And so it's kind of like, oh, that felt a little, you know, premonitious. That, you know,
a little meta.
Yeah, I know. So then, going back to the comment I made earlier in the podcast when I was like, I feel like they've been talking about this movie forever. And I was like, well, clearly they also filmed it a while ago because they were able to lock in scenes with Lance Reddick before he died.
Yeah.
And so it dated the filming for me in a way to go, well, at least the initial part of the film before the reshoots was filmed long enough ago that he was still alive, which then also reminds you, production-wise, just how long it takes to frickin' make a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but you're right. You cannot have scenes in the Continental and not have Sharon there as the concierge. Like, it's just, since movie number one, it's just... it's part of that DNA. You know, in my rewatch of Chapter 3 before seeing Ballerina, you know, when the taxi driver delivers John Wick's new dog to the Continental and the way he just kind of holds his hand out like, are you coming in, sir? And the dog goes, and then just goes and just walks right in. There's Lance is the only one who could have done that. Like he has that sense of class. And then when you actually get to see him be in action, because like if you're the concierge of an assassin hotel, probably means you're an assassin too.
Yeah it was it's one of those things where it does lead to the question, honestly, talking about the fact that Reddick is no longer going to be available for these films is the future. And you know, where does the franchise go from here? And Chad Stahelski talked about the idea recently in an interview that, you know, they're not looking to bring John Wick back from the dead. They're not looking for the John Wick 5, but they are, you know, looking towards other options. And so are you hopeful then and looking forward to, you know, more ballerina films?
I am. I really am. When the film ended and the bounty gets put on her, clearly because I assumed it was because the cult, you know, put it out on her. There were two options I was thinking. Like, the cult either did it on her or the Rusco Roma kind of just went, okay, it turned out okay, but you broke some rules and we've got to make an example out of you. I lean more towards the cult probably put the hit out. But that was my, and I mentioned that in my Letterboxd review as well. When the movie was over, my reaction was, I'm down for another one. Like, you didn't mess this one up. And if the John Wick film, if the mainline John Wick films are any indication, you have the potential for them to just get better.
Yeah, agreed.
And also, we talked about the reshoots that were done. I have a feeling that the movie, there's also a little bit of a learning curve here of, okay, so we tried to make this movie. I have a feeling that Stahelski and those who were like the godfathers of the franchise looked at it and went, it's not quite there yet. It needs to bake a little longer. And they went back into those reshoots and probably, I really think it's mainly that third act that probably they just cranked it to 11. And I'm okay with that as long as we continue to learn. And it's so nice to talk about a movie and talk about reshoots and look at a movie that when you say reshoots, you don't go, oh God, they did this. They did. It's actually nice to look at reshoots and go, thank God you did that because that was awesome.
Well, and I mean, you know, this is the thing. Look, just on the reshoots thing, movies have been doing they call them reshoots, but really a lot of times they're pickup shoots.
It's additional photography.
Yes, exactly. You're adding things that you realize, okay, we need this quick scene here to do that.
Or it was stuff that just scheduling was not going to happen during principal photography.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Or again, a lot of times, you know, you just get in the edit. Oh, we need this because this is going to make this clearer, or, you know, whatever.
Right.
So, I think this is a place where the studio was just like, hey, we really like the direction this is going. Let's add more action to it because we think it would be,
John Wick-ish.
Even better.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just even better. And so, no, I'm with you in that sense. I think that the idea of, you know, doing more of these is great. I think Ana de Armas proved herself. I think that the film itself proved itself to me that to be a worthy addition to the John Wick universe. And, you know, my thought is like, heck, if you want to bring John Wick back, I think a team up movie between them taking down the cult would be fantastic because now he's going to be wanted by the cult if he's still alive, right? And so to me, that's the kind of the perfect way to, if you're deciding we want to have him involved and we're going to say he didn't die in 4 or whatever, and that would be fantastic to have them kind of both be on the same mission and end up teaming up or something. But even if they don't do that, just having her on this mission, I think, is wonderful, and I would look forward to, you know, another film with her.
Oh, well, for me, my idea would be if we, because, you know, you talked about the fact that Lance Reddick's no longer with us. I'm looking at like another ballerina movie would be a post Chapter 4 movie, so that way Sharon is dead in the universe, so you don't even have to worry
about that.
Yeah. And what happens when you've got Eve in a post John Wick world? You know. To coin a great 90s Superman, a world without John Wick. You know, what does this world of John Wick look like without John Wick?
Right.
I'm hoping that if they do make a John Wick 5, it's like a prequel and, you know, don't bring him back. Like, don't.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
I am one of those that's like, no, chapter four, piece de resistance. Just no capes. You know, leave it alone. Keep it as it is.
Yeah.
You know, they've talked about that anime they want to do about the assignment that made him the Baba Yaga. You know, the impossible assignment. Like, it's like, we caught him at the end of his life. There's so much more to explore. And Ballerina is a way to, you know, that. The Kane movie, because, dude, after chapter four, give me that Kane spinoff, because I'd be down for that. You know, there are these other avenues that don't require bringing back Keanu Reeves from the dead.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And I think Eve operating in a world where she's got a bounty, and she doesn't have John Wick there to pull her butt out of the fire, would raise the stakes. And I would be so down for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. So where are you going to end up with your rating then for Ballerina from the world of John Wick?
So when I was writing that Letterboxd review, I was like, literally, depending in your mood, as a John Wick fan, I felt like, just as a John Wick fan, someone could probably say this is 3.5 or 4. I could easily see it going either way. But because of the reasons that I detailed here in this review, I ultimately gave it 4 out of 5 flamethrowers, because it is hot, hot, hot.
I'm right there with you, man. I went with 4 out of 5 as well. My wife and I both enjoyed this movie. I felt like that, again, I kept saying to people, this is a worthy addition to the John Wick franchise. And that's what you want to hear. And that's what you want when you go into this. You don't want to feel as though, really? No, I felt like coming out of it, not only was I glad that I saw it, I was glad that they made it, but I also thought to myself, you know what, self? I'd want to see more of that. And that's exactly what you want with this type of movie, you know? And so I can't wait to see, you know, what they do next. But, you know, Scott, speaking of that, where can people find you and talk about what you've got going on in life? And, I don't know, maybe where they can find your Letterboxd reviews.
Well, I did talk about that Letterboxd review quite a bit, didn't I? But you can find me on X at ScottDC27. You can find me on Vero at Scott McClellan. And on Letterboxd, Scott McClellan or ScottDC27. You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't really know how you find people on Letterboxd. I typically just find someone I'm already following on another social media platform. They give me a review of their Letterboxd, and I just click on it and say follow. But I do on either X or on Vero, anytime I bother to write a actual written out review, I do post it. So if you can't just go to Letterboxd and find me that way, look at one of my other socials and find one of my reviews and click on it and follow me there. But I log every movie I watch when I watch it, whether it's in theaters or at home. I rate every movie. And if I feel passionate enough about something, I actually take the time. I might write like a 1 or 2 sentence review sometimes. But like when you start seeing paragraphs, you're like, oh, Scott had thoughts. And Ballerina was a movie where I was like, Scott had thoughts, and I wanted to share those. So find me there. Also, on YouTube, at Dave the Film Junkie's YouTube channel, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Pacific, you can find me as the co-host of the DC Fanimated stream, where we are watching every single episode in order of the DC Animated Universe. We have completed Batman the Animated Series. We are in the last 3 episodes of Superman the Animated Series. And as of the time of this recording, we are about to wrap up season 1 of Batman Beyond. We don't just watch straight through a show. I did the research. I looked at air dates. and we discuss the episodes in the order you would have watched them if you were following along live in the 90s and the 2000s. So
we're
going all the way to Justice League Unlimited, but we're taking a windy path through Zeta Project, Static Shock. If it's in the DCAU, we're discussing every single episode week by week.
That's fantastic. Well, everybody, if you're just joining us, you could find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02 on, you know, Instagram, Letterboxd, also on X Twitter. So all those places, if I'm on that platform, that's the name you're going to find me under. You can also, of course, find me here on the network and a bunch of Star Trek talk with Chris Jones as we're talking about things like Star Trek Enterprise or Voyager or Deep Space Nine or Strange New Worlds, which is about to come back, or we've talked about Picard or any of those things. You can check those out. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me with a couple of shows. One's called Owl Post with Dre Kaufman, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you'll find me over on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now you're here. ¶¶